from the Metal Mayhem Studios in Rochester, New York.
Van Halen.
Always gotta have Van Halen.
I mean, Van Halen was my all-time favorite.
This week, a very special Metal Mayhem podcast. Brought to you by the letters V and H. As Vernomatic and Metal Forever Mark sit down with Greg Renoff, author of two definitive Van Halen books. Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music. And Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. They talk in-studio history of Van Halen, hidden Van Halen stories, and more. And now, here are your hosts, John the Vernomatic Verno and Metal Forever Mark.
Hello, this is the Vernomatic, and we're here live with Greg Renoff, the author of the new book, Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music. He's the co-author of this book, and he's also the author of the now famous Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Party Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. Greg, welcome to Metal Mayhem.
Hey, thank you guys for having me on. I'm looking forward to the convo.
Of course, of course. Tonight, there's a lot of topics we could go, a lot of different roads. We could talk Van Halen for hours, but we're going to condense this into a little bit of the history of Ted Templeman, how you got to know him, and get to the point of doing a co-author book with him. We're going to dive right into some of the Van Halen tidbits from the classic six albums from the late 70s, early 80s, and touch on the Van Halen Rising book. So, sure. I want to introduce you to my co-host, Metal Forever Mark.
Welcome. Thanks for Manic. It's been a little while, so nice to be back in the studio with you, actually live person versus Zoom or Skype. So, and Greg, welcome. We're excited to talk with you. Vernomatic's been talking about you and your books, I don't know, last couple of months, pretty much full on. He's a huge Van Halen fan, as you know by now. And so even though, you know, we can have that debate whether or not Van Halen's metal or not, but we'll say that for later.
Well, according to the Van Halen Rising, they saved heavy metal.
They did, right. It's right in the intro.
So, Ted, why don't you get us up to speed on the history of you and Ted Templeman, a little bio on Ted's history, and we'll get right into the Van Halen nuggets.
Well, I worked on the Van Halen Rising book for several years. And at the end of that process of writing the book, about the last year or so, I had done something like 200 interviews, and it was everyone from promoters back in Pasadena to guys and gals who went to high school with either Van Halen brothers or with Dave, former band members like Mark Stone. I had interviewed all these people, and kind of at that point, I wanted to try to go for the, you know, top of the food chain, so to speak, and I was able to find someone who was able to put me in touch with Ted Templeman, which was not easy, actually. He doesn't have a website, and he's kind of a very low profile person in terms of his life now. And I did an interview with him for the book, sometime right before the book came out. He reached out and wanted to know if he could get a copy of the book, and I said, of course. And once he got a hold of the book and read it, he told me how much he liked it and that I really got it. I understood what his perspective was, and I really expressed what he was trying to get across about Van Halen in the book. And so I was really flattered by that, obviously. And what ended up happening after that was I told a friend of mine, a guy who actually lives in Los Angeles and had seen Van Halen in the clubs and was kind of one of the people that really, from the very beginning, his name's Mike Kelly, had really encouraged me to go forward with this Van Halen book idea. And he said, why don't you ask Ted to come out to the book signing in Pasadena? And I was like, oh, I could never do that. And he goes, why not? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, it's Ted Templeman. He goes, well, he just could say no. And I was like, okay. And I asked, and he said, yeah, I'll come out and I'll sign books. And I was actually very surprised that he said yes. I later learned, interestingly enough, that Ted had applied for a job at this bookstore back in 1970 when he was thinking about leaving the record industry. So I maybe suspect that's part of what kind of intrigued him, was that this was a bookstore that he had actually gone to when he lived in Pasadena in the, basically from the late 60s up through about the early 80s, and knew the town really, really well. And I suspect that might've been part of the thing too. Like, oh, this is kind of interesting, go back to this bookstore. And so he did the book signing, and I got to know Ted after that. We started talking more in email and phone calls, and because I had never really, I had like two phone conversations with him 10 or 12 emails, and then I met him in person. So I didn't really, know him. And we started talking after that, after we spent some time together at Roman's, you know, at the table signing books, and we talked a little bit afterwards. And, eventually I pitched the idea of him to him of doing a book, and that's how it kind of started.
From the start, was the Templeman book, was the end result what you started?
Well, no. I mean, I also say I had to convince Ted to do the book. I mean, I want to, it wasn't as if Ted was... was like, oh, finally, someone's going to write a book about me. Actually, he was very reticent and kind of hesitant to do the book. And I had to sort of talk him into it. I just basically had to give him a vision for what I wanted for the book. And, it was definitely a process in doing it. I think, to be honest with you, he's not a person who enjoys the spotlight. I mean, one of the things he talked about in the book over and over again, and I may have put it in a couple of times, but I should say in the interviews, we talked about this over and over again when I interviewed him for the book, was this idea that, he sees himself as a lighting man. He sees himself as a director, someone who, he wants the people on the record or in front of the camera, so to speak, to get the credit, the people on stage. He wants, it's about the artists, it's about the performers. And so he was not super immediately comfortable with the idea of doing a biography about him. And so I had to kind of work up to the, this book, you've had an interesting life. I mean, he's not unaware of that, but I think, I was like, people will be interested, I think. And I think it's an amazing story when I really started hearing about his life. And so, then we started working through that. So to answer the second question about whether it's how it started is how it finished, I don't think that Ted envisioned it exactly the way it came out, meaning that I'm not sure he thought it was going to be basically like Ted's perspective all the way through. I think he thought of it more initially as like a music history with Ted being a central player, and rather than basically being a story driven by Ted, which is really, the only way, as I work through it, to kind of make it, I think, come to life and do justice to the story. So, it was just a, it's like any other creative process. It's, you can start in one place and go, oh, it's going to be exactly like this. But after you work through something, whether it's putting on a play or writing a song or whatever it is, it evolves. And so that sort of evolved more into sort of a straightforward bio of him.
Let's pick it up in 71. And Ted's at this point, he's working for Warner Brothers, and he started, what was his first job? He was the tape proofer.
Tape listener, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the first bands he discovered, if you will, was the Doobie Brothers.
Yeah, so Ted's first job for Warner Brothers was, as you said, a tape listener, and that was just, it's somebody who was paid a very, very minimal salary. I think he said he was making like $50 a week to just listen to tapes, just like it sounds like. You're just supposed to be a person who has good ears, and your job is to sit and play tape after tape after tape after tape and listen, and then basically try to separate the quality from the trash, basically. And that was his job. And he ended up getting a demo tape sent to him from up north, I think from San Jose. It was sent down, and it was a 4 or 5 song demo from this band called the Doobie Brothers. And Ted heard it and really was knocked out by a couple of the songs on the tape, and really liked, particularly liked the harmonies. He was a guy who liked a lot of the 60s harmony stuff, like Moby Grape. Ted was in a band called Harper's Bazaar, did a lot of harmonies, and he really liked the two-part harmony that Pat Simmons and Tom Johnson did on this demo, and liked some of the songs. And so he brought it to his superiors and said, hey, look, I think this band is something going on. And he went up north with a couple of Warner Brothers executives, got to see the Doobies in a biker bar, and Warner Brothers signed the band. And so when Ted had brought the tape, obviously he got some cred for that and was actually given the opportunity to co-produce. And that was one of the things that Ted really wanted to do. And the people at Warner Brothers knew that. And so they said, okay, you know what? You found this tape. You found this band. We'll give you a shot at kind of going and working in the studio with the band. And I should say Ted was already, had been a musician, a working musician, and made some records for Warner Brothers. So he'd already done the studio sessions as a musician. This was his chance to get on the other side of the glass behind the board and now work with the band.
Now with the Doobie Brothers, here's a funny little tidbit. This spring I did a 3-part series about a local record store, and Paul Curcio.
Yeah.
Paul Curcio was originally from up here in Rochester, New York, and came full circle and opened a recording studio in Rochester and ended up doing the first Metallica album here in town. And as I was doing research on Curcio, I keep hearing this Paul Curcio name, and I'm like, that can't be the same. And so be it. Did Ted, out of curiosity, ever mention Paul, or he was just part of
his
team?
Yeah, that's the same. Yeah, that's the same. I mean, that was Paul was the guy who brought the tape. So there were Marty and Bruce Cohn were brothers, and there was all Paul Curcio. Marty was the engineer. Paul owned the studio, and then Bruce ended up managing the Doobie Brothers. Kind of a long saga there, but yes. Yeah, I mean, that was those were the guys who brought... In fact, if you look at the first Doobie Brothers records, they're listed, at least Paul is for sure listed as an executive producer on it, you know, because he was the one who got the tape to Warner Brothers, you know, from I don't think my recollection is that Ted ever met Paul face to face when the demo was delivered. I think it was just mailed. But of course, after the record was made, Paul was the guy who had owned the studio. It was called Pacific Recorders. And that's where they did the first Doobie Brothers record at Paul's studio.
So they gets involved with the Doobies, directs them in their career, did some work with Little Feat. And some of the, of course, the first Montrose album, and that's his first exposure to Sammy Hagar. Let's fast forward up to the 76, 77, and what was the first time he heard of Van Halen? Not seeing, but hearing.
Yeah, so the first time he ever heard about Van Halen was in January of 1977. A gentleman by the name of Marshall Burrell, who later went on to manage Rat, and
sure.
was a guy who was booking the Whiskey A Go-Go in 1977. Marshall had been also an agent. He'd been a booking agent, and Ted had met him in the 60s, called Ted at Warner Brothers. At this point, Ted had a number of hit records to his name. He'd done the Doobie Brothers records, as you mentioned, Little Feat, Carly Simon. So Ted was a hot producer, and he called Ted, Marshall did, and said, hey, I've got this band for you. They do some stuff I think you might be really interested in. They got a really good guitar player, and they do these cool harmonies. Come check them out. And Ted told me that the only reason why he bothered to go down and see this band he'd never heard of, Van Halen, was because of Marshall, because he knew Marshall had been around quality. Marshall had booked the Beach Boys, and basically he knew that Marshall had good ears and was not just some guy who was just calling up, because at that point, Ted wasn't going to clubs to watch bands. I mean, he was kind of beyond that with his career. He had, you know, obviously there was a roster of artists at the Warner Brothers who all wanted to work with him as a house producer. Sure. And so when Marshall said, come on, really, you need to come down and see this, he said, okay, I'll go. And he went down to the Starwood Club on Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood in February 1977 and saw Van Halen for the first time. So the first time he ever heard the name Van Halen was when Marshall Burrell called him some, you know, a few days before and said, there's going to be basically a show you should come see.
So he goes down to the Whiskey, or the Starwood, sees the show, and went back the next night with Mo Austin and signed the band.
Correct. Yep.
So at this point, what is this? February 77 was? Were you?
Yeah. February 1977. So that would have been, you know, kind of a preliminary, like basically like a, you know, a promissory note, so to speak. Like, you know, basically we intend to sign with Warner Brothers. A deal was worked out over the next few weeks with all the, you know, the contracts and all the other stuff you can imagine that goes along with it. But yeah, basically they wanted to make sure that they had some sort of commitment from Van Halen immediately, because Ted thought that once other labels started to think, oh, Warner Brothers is interested, what, you know, basically what did we miss? Because I think the point that I want to make to people is that at that point, people knew about Van Halen. Ted might not have known, but there had been a number of labels that had kind of seen Van Halen. You know, they were playing on the Strip. They had been around for a while, and they weren't a totally unknown quantity. And so at that point, when Warner Brothers is going to go ahead and sign them, or was sniffing around, basically, Ted said to me that he really thought that it was important to try to get those guys locked up, because he didn't want them to slip away to Mercury or another label, because suddenly someone says, oh, well, if Warner Brothers is interested, we must have missed the point on Van Halen.
Greg, I want to compliment you, because with the Templeman book, it's sort of a part two from the Van Halen Rising, because in the Van Halen Rising book, the detail and the attention to detail chronicles this entire story of what Van Halen was going through, the involvement with Gene Simmons in 76, all the demos, and just the massiveness that Van Halen established in the mid-70s in Pasadena. It's documented the thousands of people, keg parties, the putting on their own shows at Pasadena Civic Center. So for the listeners that are going to go out and get the Van Halen Rising, that part of the Van Halen story is covered in complete detail. So when Templeman, they signed the band, they're on Warner Brothers, how quick did they get into the, not so much the studio, but start rehearsing? At the point they were doing a lot of the rehearsing in Dave's father's basement. Where did they go from there in 77?
Yeah, so Ted started watching their rehearsals. He actually took them into to Sunset Sound to do a demo. I mean, I never exactly figured out exactly when. It was something like 6 or so, maybe 8 weeks after they did the deal, the initial deal at the Starwood. Ted got them in the studio, and they recorded a 25-song demo that's leaked out. It's on YouTube. People can hear it. And he basically wanted them to run through their entire repertoire of originals. And from what I understand, it was basically, you know, they talked to the guys and said, okay, what's the songs you guys like best, and kind of went through and kind of put that all together on a tape to have a work tape, so that Ted could start going over it with the guys and being like, okay, this song's better than this song, and really hear everything through studio quality. And so do that. And then at that time too, Ted was, as you mentioned, was going and spending time with the band in Dave's basement. The thing that Ted had observed to me, and I mentioned in the book, is that at that time, Ted was living in Pasadena, and he was only living, you know, maybe like 2 miles from the Van Halen brothers and maybe a mile from Dave at most. I mean, he was it was just this weird thing where they all lived very, very close in that area in Pasadena. So he said that, you know, it was very easy for him, even if he was, you know, working at the studio in Hollywood late night and Van Halen was rehearsing, he could just stop over to Dave's house and, you know, midnight and watch an hour or two of them rehearsing, talk to those guys, and have a very close connection with them. You know, in some ways, unlike maybe an artist who's like based in New York is going to come out and do an album in LA with Ted, where he could really spend a lot more one-on-one time with those guys on a regular basis leading up to the making of the record.
How much of the sound, the Van Halen sound, did Ted help cultivate? Because there was, I just, through my research, I found out that two things. One, Ed Van Halen really didn't start doing a lot of the hammer-ons and pull-offs up until maybe a year before the Van Halen 1 sessions in the studio. And David Lee Roth never really had that howl that Ted really liked.
You know, I think Ted was, how would I put it? You know, Ted wanted to give credit to those guys. I mean, I think Ted would just say, like, I was just there basically like the coach, like to be like, that's good, do more of that. You know, I think he wants to give them credit for being the band that was so transformative for everybody who heard the band and how great they were. You know, that said, I'll say for Ted, if you compare the Gene Simmons demo to the Van Halen demo, which was done basically, the Gene demo was done in November 1976. And then Ted, again, was in the studio with them maybe March, maybe April to do the demo. And then when you listen to the first album, which was recorded, you know, approximately 8 months after the Gene demo, I mean, I think you can really hear the difference in so many ways. Basically, you know, how the songs are constructed and how the guitar was put down. I mean, I think one of the things that was really telling about Ted's impact is if you listen to the way that Ted really wanted to showcase just the Ed Van Halen guitar, a lot of times just one guitar track. You know, some of the songs have overdubs, obviously, but a lot of the songs on the first record is just one guitar track where it just basically it's the rhythm part through the verses and the choruses to the solo. There's no rhythm guitar. It's just him soloing live. Go back to the rhythm part and go through where, you know, Ed was more asked to overdub by Gene. And there was much more of a, I don't know, much more of a, I felt like a tentative playing by Ed on the demo. Whereas I think, you know, give Ted credit for really letting Ed loose, like basically encouraging Ed to do things like, you know, do Eruption and put it on the record. Something that Ed was like, well, what do you mean you want to put that on the record? And he's like, we're putting this on the record, you know, just, you know, basically showcasing the greatness of Ed Van Halen and saying, this is what the band's about. In part, this great guitar playing, rather than sort of, I don't know. I think Gene was more controlled in what he tried to do with the songs. Maybe he made them sound much more traditional 70s hard rock, whereas Ted, I felt like, really tried to take them into a leap forward. And I always say this, and with all respect to Gene, and in all seriousness, is that Gene only had a few weeks with those. I mean, 2 weeks with those guys, where Ted had, you know, had a lot more time to kind of mull it over. So, you know, you got to I think, cut Gene a little bit of slack, where he didn't have, you know, he didn't know those guys all that well. Basically, he was in the studio with them within like hours. Yeah, I supposedly did the first demos with those guys within 24 hours of first seeing them in a club. So, you know, Gene just wanted to knock it out because he wanted to get back on the road. So for what it's worth, you know, that's part of the, I think, the issue too, is that Gene didn't really get to know those guys the way Ted did.
Greg, you've probably been asked this question a dozen or more times at least by now, but when you talk with Ted and he was first around the Van Halen guys, was he like right away, like he knew they had something special to this band and they were going to be huge? Or was it like, hey, here's a young band that's got a ton of potential, they just need a lot of work and we can make them into something pretty cool? Or was it, hey, we got to grab one of these bands because maybe this rock metal LA scene's starting to happen? Did he give you a sense to kind of what those early impressions were like that hit him right away?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't the latter. I mean, I don't think Ted was thinking like, okay, you know, hard rock's going to come back. I don't think that was what he was thinking. I think it was much more of that he thought, in particular, this guitar player is so extraordinary and the musical talent is so unusual. If people hear it in the right context, they're going to appreciate it. And Ted really spent a lot of time talking to me about how when he heard Van Halen, and again, it's kind of a weird analogy for people, I didn't really quite get it at first either, it reminded him of bebop jazz. And I was like, well, what are you talking about? He goes, well, you know, when you would listen to bebop jazz, it would, you know, it'd be, you know, a drum, piano, bass, or saxophone and a bass. And then, you know, there would be this very stripped down sound where the saxophone solos, the Charlie Parker or whoever it was who was soloing, or the trumpet solos, would be kind of laid bare, and it would just be this incredible playing that would kind of grab you. And I think that one of the things he really thought about Ed was that if you really highlighted him, people would kind of get it in the same way. And I'm not sure I'm doing total justice the way Ted explained it to me, but that was what he heard, because he grew up as a jazz guy. But the other thing too, I think he really thought the band had just great songs and were great on stage live. I mean, he talked about how he saw them in Pasadena playing the Pasadena Civic in October 1977. So this would have been after Van Halen 1 is recorded, but before the album's come out. And he talked about how amazing it was that the crowd was into these songs that nobody had heard on a record before. Now, of course, people in Pasadena had heard the songs because they grew up with Van Halen, they were fans, but he was like kind of blown away by that, be going, man, they don't even have a record yet out, and they're already, these fans are going crazy for this band.
The Die Laughing and, sessions.
Yeah, he thought, right, exactly. He thought like this is just the energy in the room was so, just so undeniable. So, you know, I think in the last thing I would say about that in terms of thinking about the band was that, you know, Ted never said to me, well, I knew it was going to be a platinum seller, or I, you know, I knew these guys were headed to be famous. I think he really thought, though, that if they got out there and their song got on the radio, that they would have a career, you know, that they would get going. I mean, you know, maybe something, along the lines a little bit better than the Doobie Brothers, where they would kind of go out of the gate and get going. But, you know, the record was great. And I think the thing is that I'm sure Ted knew how great the record was, but there are lots of great records that come out, as we all know, that you're like, oh man, I can't believe people didn't really connect with that. They just didn't, you know, we all have records like that in our collection. We're like, oh, that's great. You know, but it didn't become a massive hit. But he, you know, he believed in those guys, and he was somebody at Warner Brothers who, much more than other people at the label, really thought these guys deserve a plug. We deserve to really push these guys because they're good, they're talented.
We're talking with Greg Renoff, the author of the Ted Templeman book, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music, and the Van Halen Rising book. So the Van Halen one gets recorded, they go on tour. They tour the world extensively for about 10 months. They take a week off. They're back in the studio for Van Halen 2. What's going on with that?
The turnaround was really quick for those guys. I mean, that was kind of the standard at the time, was about an album a year. And so Van Halen toured in 1978 from the first week in March all the way through the first week in December. You know, they were home a couple times, obviously. They didn't, you know, wasn't playing shows every single night. But that was the workload that those guys had. They had about a week off at home, and then they went to Sunset Sound and recorded Van Halen 2. The thing was that there were a lot of songs on the demo left. I mean, I think one of the things that I always think about when the Van Halen demo is that they were still pulling songs off that all the way up to 1984. So basically it provided a reservoir of quality material stretching six records. And that didn't mean that they didn't write new songs. As you mentioned, something like, Light Up the Sky was a song that Ed had written, was a new song. Dance the Night Away was a song that was a new song as well. But something like Out of Love, which didn't end up on the, it wasn't done on the demo actually, but that's an older song. Somebody Get Me a Doctor was an older song, meaning that it predated the first Van Halen record, DOA. So there was kind of a mixture of these originals that the band had written before they signed with Warner Brothers, all the way up through some newer tunes that they had written on the road or put together subsequently.
Or reworked songs, Beautiful Girls, sure. Coming back from, what was that?
Bring on the Girls,
and Spanish Fly was that. What was the story behind Spanish Fly? Ed was at a party that Ted had, and he picked up a flamingo guitar.
Yeah, people go on my Twitter, I have a picture of that guitar on my Twitter. It's kind of it was really kind of cool. I was at one of the first times I got to interview Ted. I went to his house, and it was like this guitar was sitting in the corner, and I was like, "Huh." I was like, "Hey, that's a cool Spanish guitar." He goes, "Oh yeah, that's the one that Ed played." You know, that's the one that Ed played. So Ted had bought a couple of guitars in Europe on his on a trip he took to Europe in the early '60s, and it was leaning on the couch at Ted's house, and this would have been New Year's Eve of 1978 to 1979, and Ted asked Ed to play it, and he goes, "Can you play those hammer-ons, the tapping, on acoustic too?" And he goes, "Yeah, you know, like, why not?" And he did it, and Ted said he was just like, "Fuck!" He's like, "This guy, it's just incredible, it's just amazing." And he's like, "We're gonna do this. We're gonna do the acoustic. You know, we'll do an acoustic solo for you on the next record." And they did that. So, that was it. That was at Ted's house. It was weird. And, you know, I picked it up and held the guitar, and one of the strings is broken, and And I said to Ted, said to me, he goes, that's probably the same set of strings. It's like, you know, I never, because it was just like something he just kept around the house. He didn't play it, right? You know, it just like was like a thing he just kept around. He's like, yeah, that's probably the same set of strings. So I like touched them to have a little bit of the Ed Van Halen mojo and then like didn't touch it anymore. You know, I didn't want to, you want to break another string or something like that. So I didn't play it, but it was like, it was cool.
So back in the day, Van Halen was recording these albums in, you know, a week, 10 days, 14 days. They go on tour, they tour the world again. Now, fast forward, now it's the turn of the decade, 1980, Women and Children First. First album with all originals, except for Digging in the Past on In a Simple Rhyme. Was there anything else on that album that had roots from the demo days?
Yeah, The Fools. I mean, Fools was something that's interesting. Fools was something that dated way back to and Take Your Whiskey Home. They dated back to like 1974. Those were songs that, interestingly enough, were almost, I think they'd almost abandoned them as part of the repertoire by 1977, and for whatever reason decided to revisit them, and they were done for Women and Children First. And again, that was the same, you know, the same deal. It was, you know, a quick turnaround. They toured for almost all of 19, you know, into October 1979. They came back and then did Women and Children First. And this is also the first album where Ed Van Halen plays keyboards. There's a electric piano on Cradle of Rock, mm-hmm. which is, you know, kind of a little hard to hear. People listen in headphones, you know it, but if you just hear it in the car, you know, the car and the stereo driving around or whatever, you may not be able to hear it too clearly. But yeah, there's electric piano on there.
Now, when they did that live, obviously Mike Anthony did the keyboards, so that was sort of interesting. So the band tours the world, Women and Children First, and it was at the end of the Women and Children First tour where Eddie meets Valerie down in Louisiana. And in my opinion, and maybe you'll agree with me, but the dynamics of the band started changing. It's the 80s. Things are a little different. Ed's growing up a little bit. The Fair Warning album's on the horizon. What did Ted have to say about any of this, or what's your interpretation?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the thing that Ted always talked about was, with Valerie, was that he thought it was kind of messed up that some of the guys in the band were not, enthusiastic about the fact that this guy had fallen in love with a woman and wanted to marry her. And, you know, Ted actually was kind of, to be honest with you, pissed off about that, some of the guys in the band, Alex and Dave particularly, from what I understand, were kind of like, trying to get Ed to sort of think about it, you know, don't jump into this thing. And, you know, I'm not saying that Ted felt like he should, like, you know, tell Ed, you know, marry her tomorrow or anything like that, but that, you know, basically that somebody would suggest that, hey, the band is more important than maybe, you know, your life partner, you know, that type of thing, where I think Ted took that to be kind of maybe a bridge too far until he, in terms of what he thought Ed should have to endure, and said to Ed in Sunset Sound in a break one day that if you want to quit Van Halen, you know, I'll go with you. I'll quit too. You know, these guys, this isn't right, basically, that some of the guys are, you know, trying to pressure you to basically break it off with Valerie. And you know, again, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there. I mean, I don't know what the context of the conversation was, but that's basically the way Ted explained it, that he just said to him, look, if you're miserable from this and it's making you miserable in Van Halen, we'll go and we'll do something else. We'll do a Eddie Van Halen solo album. And again, I'm just using that as an example, but that's what Ted said. He would back, I'll back you to the hilt, basically. You know, I'm not going to stand back and let those guys, put you in a position where you feel like you have to choose between a career in a band or your potential wife.
Because you look at the timeline, and it's hard for people, listeners now, to relate to this, but back then, spring, they get married in spring of 1981.
Right.
In three years, they went from playing clubs to, you know, top of the world, and they're growing up, and it's album, tour, album, tour, album, tour, and there's really no break. And that's a lot of activity in a three-year period. I personally think that Ed started, like I mentioned before, he started maturing, and he started probably thinking, you know, this is my band, and there's a lot of dissent. The no one's supporting him. They're even his own brother and Dave. You know how Dave was. Where did this lead to when Diver Down came around?
Yeah, I mean, Diver Down to me, and that's the kind of the way I wrote it up in the book based on my conversations with Ted. I mean, and again, I'm trying to tell the story. I tried to like really spend a lot more time focused on Diver Down than I did on Fair Warning in terms of the problems that started in the band, because was something that for Ted was an unsatisfying experience. So one of the things he talked to me a lot about was that, the initial thing that happened after the Fair Warning tour, so this would have been the end of 1981, was that Van Halen, the band, wanted to do a single, just to do a 45, just to kind of put it out there. Presumably, you know, Des Tedka thought, he thought that, well, maybe those guys thought that would kind of give them some breathing room, that, you know, they've been on the road, they're all, you know, they're burned out, like, oh, we'll put out the single and everyone will like it, and then we can basically buy ourselves 4 or 5 months before we have to go do a record. Well, and the other thing they were doing, they wanted to put out a video. So MTV is in its infancy, mm-hmm. and they come up with this idea to do this video based on Pretty Woman. And so Ted goes in the studio and he's not really hip about the song. He's like, well, whatever, if you guys want to do Pretty Woman, I guess we can do it. And, you know, Ted talked about in the book how he thought it was kind of, in his mind, backwards, that the focus was really about like, oh, we're going to do this video and we'll do the song. Like, you know, basically, like, to Ted, the video should be like the absolute afterthought. Like, we're not thinking about videos. We're just going to, if we're going to record a cover song, it should be about the song, not about like, oh, this would make a funny video or whatever those guys were thinking. And so the song comes out, it's a hit. And this would have been in January 1982. It starts getting played on the radio. MTV bans the video, for what it's worth. You know, that always helped for publicity. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of humorous now, obviously, because the video is so, like, you know, cartoonish. And so it's like they banned that. It's like, you know, are you kidding? And but then what happens is that Warner Brothers, basically the president of Warner Brothers, the people above Ted, start going, hey, Ted, your band, you know, they're hot. Let's get an album from them. And so this becomes this thing that management from Van Halen and the rest of the people at Warner Brothers are saying, you know, hey, we need a record. And they have to rush in the studio to do a record fast because Van Halen has a hit single and you want to ride that wave of publicity going, oh, they've got, you know, you don't want to like let that single disappear and then 2 months later have something else come out. People were like, oh, now there's something else for Van Halen. They wanted to kind of make it all of one piece suddenly when that was not the plan. So they had to rush and do this record. And there was a lot of, you know, a lot of complications in that process, and also a lot of compromises that were made that were dissatisfying to Ted in some ways, or I gave more to the point, probably dissatisfying to Ed, where Ed maybe didn't express that really clearly to Ted, didn't say, I don't like this idea or I don't want to do this. Probably because Ed understood they were just trying to finish the record at the time. It wasn't like you could be like, well, let's stop the presses here and spend 3 weeks trying to fix this. It was, they had to literally do it as fast as possible. That was basically the way Ted described it. It had to be done, you know, at an insane pace to get it out there.
If they had such a huge back catalog of go-to undeveloped songs that ended up coming later on, the House of Pains and whatnot, how come they didn't put some of those on there?
Well, I presume there's a couple things going on. Number one, with Dancing in the Street, the Martha and the Vandellas song, that I know was by design to try to put a hit single on the Diver Down record, meaning when the Diver Down record appeared in record stores in April or whenever, I think April it came out, Pretty Woman had already run its course, or would have already run its course. So usually when a record comes out, there's the lead single, and of course, you know, a week later, the actual 33 and a third record was in the store. Well, Pretty Woman had been out for 3-4 months already, so they wanted a second, or Ted particularly would have wanted another song in there that you can go to radio and go, Here's another Van Halen single. And that's one of the reasons why Dancing in the Street, which was really, you know, meant to be kind of a radio friendly song.
Dancing in the street, they're dancing.
said, the way Ted described it is that all the stuff he liked to do in the past, they had always done, which was that, okay, we're going to make a record. We're going to go in the basement for 4 or 5 days, meaning they were going to meet down in the basement for whatever, a week or whatever, and go over and rehearse and go, okay, what do you guys got? You know, Ted would be like, I don't like this one, or I like this one, let's do this one, and kind of put the records together. There was no time to do that for Diver Down. So that's part of the reason why Where Have All the Good Times Gone was, you know, that's kind of a, you don't even have to think really. Like, they just had to like sharpen up the arrangement. They'd done it in the clubs for years. And so, you know, something like, you know, maybe like a House of Pain, you know, they would have had to rehearse it and then basically polish it up to where it was a fit, you know, basically something that was worthy of release in 1982 rather than just going, oh, this is the way we did it in 1977. Just like you mentioned with, you know, Beautiful Girls, you know, Bring on the Girls. Like, they did that. He said that it was, there was literally almost no time for that. They, you know, they had to go in the studio right away and to start to go and do this stuff. So things like, you know, Cathedral, which is an instrumental, was something that Ed had worked up, had done on the on previous tours. He'd done it on the Fair Warning tour.
Mm-hmm.
Happy Trails was from the demo. They had done that on the demo. You know, and Full Bug would be a song that Ed and Alex, those guys, had written on the road, because I don't think that one ever had surfaced before. You know, Hang 'Em High is a reworking of that. So that maybe that was one that they would do. They just didn't have time to do the type of rehearsal Ted said that they would normally do. So it was very slapdash, and, you know, it just got to get a 30-minute record out. You know, that was what the idea was. It was actually like 29 minutes.
Yeah, 29 minutes. Another thing that was going on, these albums were short, and the 82 tour wasn't that long. The tour started getting longer. Now they didn't have a break, but they were looking for their break, so they had to do the album quickly, get out on the road. It was a huge production, but that really only went to the end of the year. At this time, it turned out to be the last album they recorded over at Sunset Sound. Spring of 83, they get the call from the people from the US Festival, and they're offered this huge amount of money to do the US Festival.
Well, I think, you know, it's one of the things that helped make the making of 1984 so long, the album. Ed has talked about this in interviews, and Ted talked about it. Basically, they had started work on the new Van Halen record up at 5150, Ed's new studio, and then this offer came in to do this concert. And so, at that point, if I remember correctly, they had basically gotten Jump pretty together, but then they had to stop work on the Van Halen album, which would be 1984, and then spend 6 weeks prepping for this huge concert. Then after it was over, Don Landy, as engineer, and Alex in particular, Pete Angelo spent a lot of time working on the video to put together the Showtime video clips. They had to redo the vocals for Dave, and they kind of edited it together. So there was basically all of this stuff. You know, Ed basically said it was like a short tour's worth of work for basically 1 2.5 hour show. So there was all this stuff that kind of interrupted the workflow up there at 5150.
Now, in honor of the religious people handing out pamphlets outside here, is there anybody stoned here this evening? I think. There's about 300,000 people here tonight. Yeah. And we all came to celebrate sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
You know, I've been listening to that video or audio for years and watched the video. That always gets a bad rap. They said the band was really hammered and it was a bad performance. I didn't think, I've heard worse and seen worse from them. I didn't think it was that bad.
I think in the light of what it was, I mean, you can imagine it was like a weekend long party. I mean, I think you know, it was like, you know, to me, I really like that show because I always imagine that's like a, you know, it was like the biggest backyard party they ever played. They were, you know, playing to a Southern California crowd outdoors in the summertime. And, you know, it was kind of like a giant party. So I always take it in that spirit. And, you know, it was a massively successful event for Van Halen. I know the promoter lost money and all that other stuff. But, you know, without a doubt, it was a triumphant performance for those guys to be the highest paid artist in Southern California at a show that has a quarter of a million people there. It was a huge landmark for them and one of the greatest performances of their career.
And to educate my co-host over here, I think they did headline Heavy Metal Day.
Not New Wave Day.
Your boys Judas Priest was on the bill. Triumph, Ozzy, Motley Crue.
I think Quiet Riot.
Yep. Scorpions.
Yep.
And so they do the US Festival. They get locked in 5150. And at this point, Don Landy, the longtime engineer, and Ed really start bonding. And in the book, the Ted Templeman book, he mentions that there was a point where he felt, I don't want to speak for him myself, but the impression I got that he felt the bond sort of slipping away. Is that correct?
I think that's fair to say. I think, you know, Ted, in working with him on the book, really wanted to emphasize how important Don Landy was to his career, in all sincerity, not like a, oh, I just want to, like, you know, pile on the compliments on this guy because I, whatever, he's a friend of mine. You know, he really talked about it every time we talked. He's mentioned it. You know, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, pretty much every time we had a conversation over 30 minutes, he'd talk about, oh, Don, you know, it was amazing what Don could do. Don did all the stuff that made the record sound so good. And so, you know, I think it was a situation where Ed and Don got on sort of the same wavelength in a way that maybe hadn't happened before. I mean, Don had always been a guy, according to Ted, who bonded with guitar players. So Lowell George of Little Feat, Ronnie Montrose, and go down the list there. Ted always talked about that was one of the reasons of what made Don such a great engineer for rock music, particularly guitar-driven rock music, was that he just had this way of, like, getting on the same mindset as the guitar players. And Don and Ed became buddies, in part because, understand that Don was the point person for building the studio in Ed's backyard. Don was the guy who wired it. Don wasn't the only guy who worked on it, but he was really, you know, Ed's eyes and ears, so to speak, in terms of, like, oh, here's what we're doing, here's what we're going to do, this, why should we do this, and kind of, like, walked him through that stuff. So they had spent a lot of time together. And, you know, I think part of it was just this issue of Dave and Ted tended to agree more on things as well. And so you can imagine that when the tension is rising between Dave and Ed and increasing, Ted and Dave probably got lumped in together as kind of a you know, basically a pair that was trying to, you know, dissuade Ed and Don from doing what they wanted to do with the record. And I think that's sort of what happened, along with a bunch of substances and other stuff that obviously didn't help things as well in terms of communication. And certainly, you know, Ted definitely felt that he was being sidelined, so to speak. I mean, I think that's a fact.
A part of the whole correlation between the Diver Down sessions, Ed wasn't really happy with the direction it went, and now he has the ability to record at his house. And the structure of Sunset Studios wasn't there. And there was points in the book where Ted was talking about he'd show up and either he wasn't, you know, he didn't get in there, or Don and Ed were there all night. Just the structure wasn't going on there. And Eddie really wanted, he really stood behind Jump. And Dave wasn't into it. And Ted liked the song, the impression I got, but he was a little worried about the direction and the interpretation that was putting out there. And
correct.
At this point, Eddie, I felt, was growing a pair. Finally, he's like, hey, this band's my name. And I want to, in the direction it was going, elaborate a little bit on the whole Jump thing, because after the fact, it really is, if it's going to be pop, it's a fantastic pop song.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're pretty on target. I think a lot of people have missed the point, you know, didn't read the book closely or kind of missed the point. It's like, you know, Ted talked about how he thought it was a good song and thought it was a great song and thought it was super cool, but didn't think it was a great song for Van Halen. Mm-hmm. And that was what he was worried about. You know, as the producer, he was trying to think about the reception. And look, I think in fairness to Ted, I know personally, there are lots of people who heard Jump and were like, I hate, you know, what the happened to my band? Like, basically, were really turned off by it. But on the other hand, Ed was right insofar as this is the music he liked, and it made Van Halen three times as big as they were, you know. And so, and Ted recognizes both of those things are true. That for Ted, he was worried that it was going to be one of these career steps that you're like, you know, like, oh, like what were they thinking? Like, this is like, you know, I think we could point to a lot of bands where they push something in a direction that the fan base doesn't like, and it alienates fans. And so I think that Ted thought that. The other thing I want to emphasize to you guys is that Ted told me, and I think if we think about it, I think he's making a good point, even if we can understand that Jump's a great song. He's like, look, you had this incredible band with this amazing lyricist, this front man who was the best at what he did. He was one of the best creative persons I've ever seen in a studio, I mean, David Lee Roth. And you have this guitar player who is unlike any other guitar player. He's like, you know, he's like the Mickey Mantle of guitar players. You know, he's the Michael Jordan of guitar players. Use whatever analogy you want. And he's like, then you're going to say, stop doing what you're, you know, basically, don't do what you're best at anymore. Do something you're just okay at, meaning keyboards. I mean, you know, basically Ted's point was that when Eddie Van Halen played the guitar, you immediately knew it was him. He's like a Hendrix. And then you're going to have him play keyboards and you're like, well, okay, you can play keyboards and you're good at playing keyboards, but there's nothing special about how you play keyboards. You know, and that's kind of what Ted was getting at too. It's like, why would we dilute? You know, you wouldn't tell Jimi Hendrix to sit down and play the drums. You know, that's what Ted would kind of say. It's like, you know, Jimi can play the drums. He's good at playing drums, but it's Jimi Hendrix. It's like, you don't want to do anything that takes the guitar out of Jimi Hendrix's hand. And I think that's what Ted was trying to get at too. And it was, yeah, it was definitely something that Ted will go to great pains to say, look, you know, we went ahead and did the song. I didn't veto the song. You know, I said, let's do the song. You like it? Let's do it. I'm not sure it's a good idea, but let's do it. So I think Ted wants to give himself, I think, fair credit for that, to say, you know, it wasn't as if I was like stopping Eddie Van Halen from being creative at what he wanted to do. He's like, I was just had an opinion that differed. I differed about the appropriateness of making this song Central 1984. But, you know, as history shows, that's the way he was going. There was no stopping that trend. I mean, Ed was more and more keyboards, and it was more and more ballady. I don't know what, you know, what do you guys all know what I'm talking about? That's sort of like that more pop driven material. That's the way Ed was going. And so, you know, that's the saga of Jump. But I think definitely it was a landmark in a lot of ways. You know, it definitely was something that was a landmark recording for the band, but also it laid bare, you know, Roth wasn't crazy about Jump. Ted wasn't crazy about Jump in terms of for Van Halen. And it just sort of laid bare that difference of opinion about Van Halen's direction.
Well, the star of that song, and Ted told the story in the book, is Roth. The lyrics and the interpretation that he... Tell the story, Greg. Tell the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ted will talk a lot about the fact that, and he kind of educate me on this. I'd be like, oh, Ed wrote this great song. And he's like, look, he's like, yes, Ed wrote the music. Ed wrote the musical parts of it. He's like, but you don't have a song without a melody and without lyrics. Like, he'd say that to me all the time. And I was like, oh yeah, you got a point. He's like, we're not doing an instrumental record. So he basically talked about how once Dave came up with this idea of a lyrical concept of Jump as this kind of anthem about, you know, hey, going for it and kind of taking a chance and, you know, basically being able to have this message in the song that he thought everyone could relate to, while also having this sort of pop idea of this, like, one word you can chant, Jump, you know, and everyone can kind of like get behind. He said that was just brilliant. And so, you know, Tim, that's the other thing that I think Ted was kind of bittersweet about, was that, you know, even though there was this conflict between those guys about the direction of the band, Ed and Dave were still able to work together and make this number one hit. You know, they were able to kind of like write this great lyric that everyone could sing along to. And Ed came up with all these amazing parts and the catchy riff and the solo and the, you know, the whole thing. I mean, that's what I think. That's one of the things that Ted's like, it was amazing to see, to go from this thing when I was like, nah, you know, it's cool, whatever, to when it was finished, meaning the lyrics, the melody, the whole, every, all the pieces were together. I think for Ted, when the lyrics were there and the melody, the whole piece was put together with Dave and Ed's parts together, he said, this is amazing. This is amazing. He said, it might ruin Van Halen. And he said, actually, you know, said that in the book. I think it's like, I'm afraid it was going to be the end of Van Halen in terms of a, you know, as their direction, as a, you know, basically their direction. If people really hate it, they like don't accept it. But he's like, what, he thought it was a cool song. And I think that's one thing that I think it's easy for people to misunderstand what Ted was trying to say. Like, you can appreciate a song and say, I don't think was appropriate for this group at that moment in time. And that was Ted's opinion in the summer of 83 before the record came out, obviously.
A couple of quick clearing ups. Van Halen Rising. After you did the book, a couple things. Did any people reach out and comment on any of the stories or situations that you presented? What would you do differently? And would you do a revision or an add-on chapter or two?
If you're talking about people in the band or I mean, you know,
no, like people I, you know, that were there, like,
oh yeah, hey, I mean, yeah, I mean,
parties,
yeah,
I got
yeah,
pictures.
Yeah. Yeah, there were people who, you know, there was always people who kind of, you know, I didn't know about, or I couldn't reach. There were a couple of individuals who kind of wanted to talk to, and they did whatever, they weren't available. I couldn't reach them. And, you know, that, I think that's, kind of par for the course for this mm-hmm. type of thing. Anyone who's done a book like this is like, oh, those people like, oh, you know, after the fact, they're like, I wish you, you know, wish I had done it or something like that. But, you know, in terms of an add-on chapter or something like that, I mean, I think, you know, there were certainly, I think, a couple of areas of the book where, you know, I could do more. I mean, like, you know, at the point where there was so much stuff from the 78 tour. There were so many cool stories. I mean, I almost had to, you know, kind of do the highlights of the best stories for the tour where, you know, there were plenty of things that ended up happening to those guys where they, you know, playing and, arenas with Sabbath and sort of the growth of their profile. I wish I could have done more than that, but at that point, you know, I didn't want to make the 1978 chapter like, you know, 150 pages long. But yeah, there was like, you know, obviously it was super well documented, obviously, because they're, you know, they're on the road, there's newspapers, there's radio interviews, there was more stuff. But, you know, you sort of want to give a little bit of balance to it where you don't make the book sort of so top heavy at the end of the book.
Hey, Greg, you just reminded me of something. I don't know if you're familiar with the comedian Jim Florentine.
I am.
Okay, so we at Vertimatic and I had a chance to interview him when he came through Rochester last summer. And somehow we just started talking about rock, you know, great shows that he remembers. And he somehow uh-huh. talked about that. So they toured with Sabbath, right, on that very
yeah.
first tour.
Uh-huh.
That was okay. And he said that there was a rumor that Van Halen blew Black Sabbath off the stage at the Garden. What were your thoughts about, was that rumor out there at the time, or is it still out there? And
it's been,
you know,
known.
I think, you know, when I talk to people, obviously I talk to more Van Halen people, but I've talked to a lot of Sabbath fans. I mean, I think with most people, they were going to say that Van Halen was surprising to them, like how good they were. You know, they may say, well, Sabbath wasn't blown off the stage, but I mean, even Ozzy has said that. So, I mean, I think that's the thing I always try to go back to is that, you know, I know that in Tony Iommi's book, he seemed a little bit more defensive about it. But, I mean, Ozzy for years has said, you know, they blew us away. We were just, you know, we were basically burned out. We were done. And we were just, yeah. you know, bloated, basically. And we're like, these guys came out. They, you know, they basically buried us. Yeah, that they buried us night after night. And, I have no doubt that Van Halen had bad nights. But the thing I also try to point out to people is that, which I think may go not noticed, is that Van Halen and...
Scott, did we lose him?
Greg, are you back?
I'm here.
All right. Sorry about that.
Sorry about that. Hey, we know we're over the 60-minute mark, so we're going to just go rapid fire through a couple of things. Do you still got a few more minutes for us?
Of course.
Okay, sorry about that. John, did you want to add anything? And then
basically, the Sabbath thing. So
yeah, I don't even know how we got on that subject. Anyway,
let Mark wrap it.
So let me just do this one first, and then I got a couple to finish. So we had this Metal Mayhem ROC mailbag. This was from one of our listeners, Mike Lomenzo from New York City. His question is, did Ted ever talk to you or mention plans for Van Halen to have a live album with David Lee Roth?
You know, he never did. The thing that's interesting is that I asked him about that and he just sort of shrugged and was like, I don't remember ever talking about a live album. Yeah, I would have thought that that would have come up. And again, he may not remember. It may have been discussed, but he never remembered it when I talked about it.
Okay.
There was probably no time to do a live album, you know.
Yeah. And I guess the other question is there a pro shot video of that 81 Oakland promo clips that got out?
I believe there has to be.
That's a bootleg, right? That
No, it's the three promo videos shot.
Got it.
Your take?
Yeah, I mean, Ted wasn't really like looped in on all that stuff in terms of like that type of in terms of what they were going to do with their video. But yeah, I mean, I am 100% confident there is there's unreleased stuff sitting somewhere that maybe one day I'll see the light of day. But yeah, you know, the thing is, it's I think Van Halen, if it's proven anything over the last couple of decades, is that they're not exactly into archival releases. So I wouldn't hold your breath.
They're not into anything. The reason I think that there's the company line was they said they only filmed three songs, which is BS, because at the beginning of one of the clips, I saw the tour. They have the lit VH that came down during Ain't Talking About Love.
Right.
It's in one of the shots. And hey, who shoots three songs when you get the crew there? So
Greg, having kind of replayed this whole Van Halen experience and having the interviews with the guys and getting to know Ted like you have, I mean, there's a lot of people that say that the 80s, 70s, 80s genre was a really unique period of time and all these big arena bands were born and what have you. I mean, in your viewpoint, do you think those days are kind of quote-unquote over, or do you still think a band like a Van Halen or a Motley Crue or Metallica could still break and become a big arena band, or is just the landscape changed so much now that that's just not possible?
Well, I mean, I think if you talk to the average 20-year-old, the whole notion of arena rock doesn't exactly light them on fire. But that said, I mean, I think there are bands that come along that are guitar-driven rock bands. I mean, one band I like a lot is Blackberry Smoke. I mean, I don't think they're ever going to be able to play arenas, but they have a great following. They are, 10 years into their career, 6-7 albums into it, and you know, they're basically playing what people would call kind of heritage Southern rock, for lack of a better term. I don't think that's totally fair to what they do. You know, so I think there's an audience you can cultivate. I know that they have plenty of younger fans, but yeah, I have trouble believing that 10 years from now there's going to be some sort of turn. But you know, the thing about music is you never really can probably predict what's gonna take off and, you know, have a revival. But I don't see it coming.
And by the way, Vernomatic's wearing the Van Halen Rising t-shirt. I want to read this quote.
Nice.
It says on there, how a Southern California party band saved heavy metal.
Yeah.
Basically the thesis of the book, right?
That's
there.
That's the title.
So tell me, where does that tagline come from? Because then, you know, we're a heavy metal podcast and we love metal, and everybody that loves metal loves Van Halen. So
right. So this was actually, this was actually really fun when the book came out, because I got a lot of hate from a lot of people who were saying, you know, Van Halen's not a heavy metal band and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I would agree with that. Van Halen's not a heavy metal band. And I really went to great pains to try to explain in the book that if you look, for example, at a Cream magazine circa 1977 and they talk about heavy metal, it was like Heart and Kiss and Queen.
Pat Benatar.
I mean, that was what heavy metal was called.
Oh, that's
and that's
Nugent.
The way, that's exactly, Ted Nugent, exactly. And that's the way people at the time would have lumped a band like Van Halen, and they would have said that's a heavy metal. It's just more heavy metal. And so what I was trying to say and why I wrote the book was that at the time Van Halen came out in 78, that type of music, whether it be Nugent, Kiss, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, that type of mountain, that type of music seemed to be declining. Disco, soft rock, punk rock, new wave seemed to be the genres that were really poised to get bigger or to stay big. Disco was huge, obviously. Soft rock, I mean, Linda Ronstadt, Eagles, all that stuff was big. Southern rock. And so this idea of Van Halen coming along and having a platinum record was shocking to a lot of people, actually. I mean, it was shocking to everyone at Warner Brothers, really, except Ted, who thought, you know, these guys are talented. And so for me, I always see Van Halen as kind of a bridge between the late 70s and the early 80s stuff, where the Motley Crue, the Motley Dawkins, the Rats, they basically, you know, basically held the fort. And I, you know, I talk about it in the book as well, and I think people miss this as well, as, you know, bands like AC/DC, Judas Priest, those bands were around, Scorpions were around, were making records in the late 70s, but none of their records were really big in 78. I mean, in other words, Van Halen's record did much mm-hmm. better commercially. And so, definitely. You know, I talk about it as in the book as pop metal. I mean, I'm not saying like, you know, Van Halen is like Metallica. I'm saying it's at the time people were going to categorize a band like Van Halen, they were going to call them heavy metal. They were going to call... Yeah. You know, they were going to call Kiss heavy metal. They were going to, again, we go through the whole list of Queen. They were going to call Queen heavy metal. Bands that we'd be like, well, Queen's not a heavy metal band. At the time, that was the way they were categorized. So that's the way I kind of saw, you know, Van Halen is kind of sticking out there in 78 as this band that nobody thought had a chance to do anything and to be super successful, having a song like You Really Got Me and Jamie's Crying played on the radio, which is, again, like, it's like it's pop songs played with the flourishes of heavy metal, the guitar, pyrotechnics, the screams. And so that's the way I kind of saw, rather than saying like, you know, Van Halen is like Slayer. I mean, people were like, Van Halen is nothing like Slayer. And I'm like, I'm not saying that. That's not the argument of the book. I mean, you know.
Well, they do. They get lumped in all the bands you just mentioned, the Dokken, Rat, you know, Motley Crue. I mean, and all those bands would all say that Van Halen, their success and popularity definitely helped all those other bands gain that LA glam rock metal scene. I mean, they're definitely lumped in a part of all of that. There's no question about it.
Many have tried, most have failed, only a few survived. This is the Mount Rushmore of metal.
So I would say, you know, ultimately my Mount Rushmore of bands would be Van Halen, The Doors. The Doors, and I don't listen to The Doors a lot, but they were one of like the first band I actually really, really got into. This would have been around 1980. And I would, you know, I have such divergent, you know, taste. It's hard for me to put too much, but if I'm going to put them on Mount Rushmore, I know that's politically controversial now. I don't want to get too off track. Right.
Show segment becomes political. For us.
Exactly. It's like super political. you know, I'll put Sabbath and Zeppelin on there. You know, I'll put The Doors, Van Halen, Sabbath and Zeppelin on there, which I think, you know, I mean, you give me a the Sabbath catalog, I'm happy. But, you know, even some of the 80s stuff, you give me the Zeppelin catalog, I'm happy. So, yeah.
So why? So were you already a fan of like this rock music genre when you went to write Van Halen Rising? Or it was just like a interesting project that came across your desk? Or how would you describe?
Oh, yeah.
Tell the story.
Yeah, no, I was a kid who... you know, saw Jump on MTV. I probably had heard, I always say, I know it. I heard Pretty Woman on the radio, but I was like, oh, whatever. You know, it was just like another song. It was like, and now something from Rick Springfield. It was just a song. Right. But when I saw the Jump video, that really was something that electrified me. And then I got to see the 1984 tour. I was lucky to be able to see that. That was amazing. And that, you know, made me a huge fan. I had already started hacking around a guitar a little bit, but I tried to, you know, now I tried to really improve my guitar playing, which didn't work all that well. So, you know, it was something, you know, I didn't write Van Halen Rising until I was in my 40s, but you know, I had been a fan for decades through all the, you know, the false reunions and the Van Halen 3 and the kind of all the, you know, the ups and downs of the band. I'd hung in there through, you know, just what, you know, like anybody, like, oh, what's Van Halen up to now? Oh, they just put out, you know, this album with Gary Cherone. What? You know, that whole type of thing. So it just was, you know, Sammy Hagar's gone, you know, he's back. And so, you know, but it was for me, yeah, I was a historian at that point, and I saw this as a history that I thought needed to be told and I thought would be interesting to people to tell basically the prehistory of this amazing band that was around playing parties and clubs for years before they were quote unquote discovered.
Well, I can give you a little 30-second synopsis. I got into Van Halen because I had an older brother. So when Van Halen 1 came out, I remember hearing "You Really Got Me," and I remember my brother and his buddies jamming it. And I remember, I'll post it on my Twitter, my brother going to the Van Halen 2 concert. They used to come to Rochester every May. And little tidbit, you probably knew the three videos from Rochester. My father wouldn't let me go to the Women and Children First concert. He wouldn't let me go to concerts until I was 13. So he wouldn't let me go to the women's show, but my first Van Halen show was that Fair Warning.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's the War Memorial?
Rochester War Memorial, May 18th, 1981.
Wow.
And yeah, I know. I don't want to rub it in, but it was all that. And then Diver Down up at Carrier Dome and Dave's birthday. Yep. Buffalo 84, and on July 9th or 7th, 1985, my buddy came running into Perkins, late night eating, says, "Roth leaves Van Halen," and things haven't been the same ever since. No, it's like,
so, I always talk about that really quickly. I always talk about how, like, you know, when I saw Farm Aid, it finally hit home. It's like, you know, it's like your parents are going to get divorced or something. And you're like, "Oh, Dad's never going to move out." And then suddenly he's like, got his bags and he's gone. You're like, "It's happening. And, it's actually happening." I was like, "Holy shit. It's over. It's really over."
30 seconds or less, your take on a different kind of truth.
I think considering how old those guys were and how long they had not been in a studio together, I think it's a really good, solid album. I think it holds up well with the original six albums. I mean, I don't think it's as good as, you know, I'd rank it seventh, obviously, but I think especially I would give an enormous amount of cred to Roth's lyrics, which I thought were some of the best of his career.
Fantastic. They're
really, really clever. If you read them, you're like, wow, this is, listen, they're really, really clever. I mean, you know, the whole idea of the rehashed demo stuff. I mean, I've sort of like, you know, the deal is, as we just talked about, Van Halen always was going back to the well to kind of pull up old stuff. So I think, look, the idea of those guys getting in a room and putting, you know, rehearsing and coming up with 10 new songs, considering the icy relationship between Roth and Dave, I mean, that wasn't happening. So the fact that they got that album out and it did well and they toured behind it and it's going to be there forever, great.
Well, they did some new stuff. Honey Baby Sweetie Doll, that was new. Stay Frosty, that was new. There's a couple others, but here's a trivia question. Which song off of that is inspired from the Two Burritos and a Root Beer float segment from Two and a Half Men?
I know. Wait a minute. Hold on. As is.
There you go. Dr. Halen comes through.
I was like, Final Jeopardy. I was like, wait. Yeah. I kind of had a brain freeze for a second, but I pulled it out.
All right, we got to get out of here, but
what if I got one more? Sorry, we could probably go all night for sure. That's how these things go with us. But what if they did one big, massive Eddie's health notwithstanding? Clearly, hopefully that ends up okay. But what if they just did one big, massive double album? Let David Lee Roth do side one and Hagar do side two and call it a career.
I don't think that'll ever happen. I'll tell you, I have always been, for the last 3 or 4 years, of the mind that if they're going to go out, you know what? Just do whatever. Do like the Sammy set, Dave set. I mean, I know it would never happen, but I would, you know, some people will want to crucify me for saying that, but just put a capstone on the career, you know, just do it and just walk away with your head held high and say goodbye. I just think,
some people don't, unless you're really deep into metal. There's a band called Helloween from Germany, and Michael Kiske, which was one, you know, the original singer, after 20 some odd years, he came back and they did a huge big old tour with both singers.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's pretty. Check out. There's some really good YouTube live shots of pro shots of that tour, and they just did all the songs and they wrote a couple new ones, and it was a really big happy Halloween party. So,
well, I mean, I think it's like always, like for me, it's like even like now with like I really like the Bush era Anthrax stuff. I really
Me too. Totally.
I liked the '80s stuff, but for whatever reason, the Bush era stuff I really connected with that. And then it's sort of like we don't do that stuff anymore. I get it. You know, you have different singers, different eras, and I get that. But there's sort of this whole thing like where we like bury the other airing it like it doesn't exist, like the Tony Martin stuff. I'm going through Spotify, and I'm like, there's only one. Where's the Tony Martin stuff?
You know, Seven Star, just, the Tony.
Yeah, Martin. like Headless Cross. Come on now, I want my Headless Cross on Spotify. You know, it's right. It's like totally. They just, you know, this idea of, like, you bury the other era, like, oh, it didn't happen or something. I don't know. It's just, I just think, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with Eddie's health, but I really find it difficult to imagine Eddie and Alex agreeing to do like a 50 city tour next year with Roth or something like that. So, like, you know, just kind of put a capstone on it and say, hey, look, it was a great career. No one's going to begrudge them anything. They've done it all. They've been at the top, and, you know, it's just like what Zeppelin did, like the one night, just do the one thing and say goodbye.
Love it. So everyone could visit the Metal Mayhem ROC Facebook or website, show notes. And Greg, why don't you shoot out how people could get in touch with you? The books are where? Amazon, Van Halen News Desk?
Yeah, their Amazon has them. Van Halen News Desk, always Van Halen store has them. If anyone wants a signed copy directly from me, you can go to templemanbook.com. And otherwise, follow me on Twitter at Greg Renoff. And I'd love to connect with people that way and talk. And yeah, it'd be great. Appreciate this very much, guys. It was a lot of fun, as always.
All right. Well, thank you. Crank Halen. And we'll talk to you on Twitter.
Greg, great job with the books, by the way. You did a great job with an amazing band. So you did it a justice. So thank you so much.
It is. I'm thank looking forward guys. To the third one. Take care.
See you guys later.
All right, take care, man.
Bye.
Metal for Life.
Thanks for listening to Metal Mayhem ROC. Check out our websites at metalmayhemroc.com and metalforever.com for information on upcoming concerts, podcasts, archives, and all sorts of info. Please like, follow, and share with everyone, even your non-metal friends. Catch us next time on WLFE DB Radio.